Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we consider the humble yet mighty bean. We begin with its role as cultural icon, celebrated each Lundi Gras at the Red Beans Parade. The crew of Red Beans founder, Devin DeWolf, tells us about the perils of parking their bean-covered hearse.
You have to worry about the rain and the rats and the bugs, but these are just some of the pitfalls of being in a bean-centric parade.
Then, Richard McCarthy tells us how beans connect to Slow Food USA's mission to provide good, clean, and fair food for all.
Plant the change, eat the change.
Be the change.
Be the change. Or bean the change.
Bean the change. We're talking with people who really know their beans on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. With the New Hampshire primary now over, focus is now shifting west to Nevada. Presenter of member station KUNR reports Nevada's caucusing system is under scrutiny after a chaotic week following the caucuses in Iowa.
This year, Nevada will be the first state to have early voting for its caucus, which is set to start Saturday. But Nevada State Democratic Party staff members are scrambling to retrain its 3,000 volunteers. That's because the party ditched its caucus reporting and early voting apps. They were developed by the same company that made faulty software that led to delayed results in Iowa. But with just 10 days left until caucus day, the party hasn't publicly said how the results will be reported. Nevada Democratic officials didn't respond to requests for comment for this story. On Tuesday, the party said early votes will be recorded on a paper ballot similar to a Scantron. Early voting ends next Tuesday, but results will not be available until caucus day. For NPR News, I'm Bree Zender in Reno.
Chinese authorities are reporting that for a second straight day, there have been no new cases of the coronavirus, offering some hope in an outbreak that's already infected more than 45,000 people since December. The vast majority of the cases are in China. More than 1,100 people have died from the disease. Cambodia has agreed to grant entry Thursday morning to thousands of passengers and crew from a cruise ship that was barred from docking by four other governments over coronavirus fears. Holland America Line, which operates the vessel, says there it has no confirmed cases of the disease stemming from the outbreak in China. The United Nations is identifying dozens of businesses for alleged human rights violations in the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is rejecting the report's findings. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Jerusalem.
The UN's Human Rights Office issued a list of 112 businesses that it believes are involved in activities related to Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis have settled in the West Bank, land where Palestinians seek an independent state. The UN Human Rights Office says these West Bank settlements are illegal under international law. The UN report identifies businesses like banks, construction, and telecom companies it says help support settlements or disadvantage Palestinian businesses. Most of the companies are Israeli. The rest are American and European. It's a long-awaited report that Israel lobbied against releasing. Israeli officials say it's a biased blacklist, while the Palestinian Authority calls it a victory for international law. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen 225 points since the open. It's at 29,498. From Washington, this is NPR News. Federal agents are on the scene of a shooting in Baltimore in which two law enforcement officers reportedly assigned to a U.S. Marshals task force were hurt. The suspected gunman has been killed. A Florida jury has found a Chinese national not guilty of trespassing on President Trump's part-time residence at his Mar-a-Lago resort, but Jing Liu was convicted of resisting a police officer without violence when she was arrested last year. She was the second Chinese citizen in 2019 charged with trespassing on Trump's resort in Palm Beach. The British oil giant BP is pledging no new carbon emissions by the year 2050. NPR's Camilla Domonoske reports it's an ambitious goal for a fossil fuel company.
Some oil and gas companies, especially European ones, are vowing to take action on climate change. Now, BP is joining the front of the pack. It's promising net zero emissions in 30 years. And yes, that's factoring in all the oil and gas BP sells. The company didn't provide many details, but that would likely require more renewable energy plus carbon capture through new tech or planting trees. BP also says it will advocate for public policies like carbon pricing. This is not the first time the company has pledged to go green. 2 decades ago, it said BP stood for Beyond Petroleum, but that was more slogan than long-term strategy shift. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
The Dow is up 0.75% since the open, or 225 points at 29,501. The S&P is up 0.5%. NASDAQ also up 0.75%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Home Advisor, committed to helping homeowners find the right pros for their home projects. Homeowners can read reviews, book appointments, and check cost guides for home projects at homeadvisor.com or on the mobile app.
Born on the Bayou, with music from John Fred, Van Broussard, Don Rich, Fats Domino, Rod Bernard, T.K. Hulam. Lee Kleinpeter with you for an hour of solid Louisiana gold, Saturday afternoon at 3 on KRVS for Born on the Bayou. Join me for an enduring and endearing hour of swamp pop and more this Saturday on KRVS, Born on the Bayou.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a backyard staple for 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Let's all Louisiana. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. New Orleans' love affair with the red bean is as historied as the city itself. Our Red Bean Monday tradition is said to have been born from the practicality of simmering a pot of beans, with the ham bone left over from Sunday dinner, on Monday, wash day. In the last few decades, red beans and rice have become such a popular local dish that Leah Chase used to say, "Red beans used to be only for Mondays," until those tourists expected her to cook them every day. On this week's show, we're shining a spotlight on the humble bean. We begin with Devin DeWolf, founder of the Crew of Red Beans. If you've never attended their Lune de Grasse celebration, you'd better get that on your calendar this year. Devin explores their growth as well as their year-round red bean activities, part of what makes being a crew member such fun. Then, Chicago-based celebrity chef Rick Bayless talks about the place of the red bean and all beans in his cuisine. Finally, we return home to learn what makes the red beans and rice served annually at Jazz Fest such a crowd-pleasing favorite. We're celebrating the humble but mighty bean on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I am Devin DeWolf, founder of the Crew of Red Beans.
Every year after Halloween, members of the Crew of Red Beans break out their hot glue guns and begin creating their costumes for the next year's Mardi Gras. Forget sequins and rhinestones. This crew employs only edible adornments, dried beans. Collectively carrying some 500 pounds of beans on their costumes, members strut their stuff through the street on the day before Mardi Gras, which also happens to be the traditional Monday red bean day in New Orleans. When Devin DeWolf founded the Crew of Red Beans over a decade ago, he had no idea he was creating a Lune de Grasse tradition that would develop a cult following. The annual parade has gotten so popular that 3 bean parades will be marching this year. We sat down with Devin to discuss the crew's expansion from a Lune de Grâce marching parade to a year-round institution.
Well, this began about 11 years ago when I made a Halloween costume out of beans, and the people in New Orleans really reacted to it, which got me thinking, and had just gone through my first Mardi Gras, and I, for some reason, decided that the next Mardi Gras, my second, I would create a parade where people would make bean suits and second line on Monday, because Monday is the day of red beans. We started small, you know, the first couple years it was very small, and it steadily grew and grew and grew, and then it kind of blew up a little bit in terms of the audience that would come and parade with us. And to help split the crowd up a little bit to maintain the sanctity of a small, magical neighborhood parade, mm-hmm. we have offshoots. 2 years ago, we started the Dead Beans Parade. The third is going to be called Feijão, which is Brazilian, Portuguese, and it translates to the big bean.
Ah.
And it harkens sort of back to my life story of living in Brazil for a year, which is where I discovered beans and fell in love with beans because I was eating beans twice a day every day, as Brazilians do. And this new parade will be mainly in Bywater, and the musical base is Brazilian. We have two Brazilian groups that'll be kind of like heavy percussion carnival music from Brazil, and on Monday at 2 p.m., the day before Mardi Gras, Lundi Gras, we will have three parades that are bean-focused all happening at the same time.
And so you'll now have parades simultaneously in the Marigny, the Bywater, and Mid-City, and you all will all meet up somewhere, I imagine, for the big Lundi Gras bean rumble, huh?
Yeah, they all come together at the end, which is quite nice because it's almost like, oh, my long-lost friends, I haven't seen you in a couple hours, and here we are together in our bean suits in the Tremé. And, you know, the thing about having these multiple parades that are all happening at the same time is there's no bad choice, and it kind of allows you to jump into different worlds. So you can be in the Brazilian world, and then you can jump into the traditional New Orleans world, or you can enter the dead beans world. So it's kind of fun for the crew members to switch year to year, and also I think fun for the spectators. You know, on Lundi Gras, I think between 10 and 15,000 people probably come and join us on the streets. So it gets to be pretty big. And many of them make their own bean suits and just show up. And we don't know who they are, but they're in a bean suit. And some of the bean suits are quite nice. It's really awesome to see the spectators becoming part of the thing and the lines being blurred.
Originally, in the original parade, there was the Camellia bean car, because you and Camellia, you're like this, huh?
They give us all the beans every year.
What happened to the bean car?
Well, this is the second iteration of the bean car, which is a 1970s Volkswagen thing. And they had it somehow, and the company asked us if we would cover it in beans, which obviously we can handle that type of assignment. So we did it, and then it lasted a couple years. It got rained on real bad at Hogs for the Cause 1 year, and it had to be remade, which we did. And then the second version of it was horribly eaten up by some type of locust or plague or some kind of thing.
Oh, that's terrifying. I'm glad there's no film of it.
Yeah, it's very sad. We also have a bean hearse, and there was definitely a rat eating the black eyed peas off the hearse right before our parade.
Did you catch the rat in the act?
We did not. He would come at night after the mechanic went home, and he steadily chipped away at some of the lettering, and he ate some of the eyes out of one of the bean skeletons on the side of the hearse.
It makes it extra creepy, Devin, I have to say.
It does. And these are just some of the pitfalls of being in a bean-centric parade, because you have to worry about the rain and the rats and the bugs. But, you know, we forge all of these challenges, I think, relatively well.
Well, what I really love is the way you have taken this original concept, just over a decade old, and somehow the crew of Red Bean prevails throughout the entire year. The crew of Red Bean isn't just about Mardi Gras. Tell us about how the year rolls out from your high, high holy day on Lundi Gras.
Sure. Well, I think there's a deeper meaning in these traditions that we've created and the act of bringing people together. So the real purpose and mission of our crew is to create friendships and to help people get to know each other. And, you know, you have this shared common interest, which is making a bean suit. And so we've sort of added programming in our crew over the years. And now it's sort of like there's a season of bean, which for us, we have like the appetizer in the fall where we get together for dinner clubs and things like that. And then Halloween is when the costume season really begins.
We Halloween?
Halloween is what we call it. And it's become our crew's annual fundraiser and just a really good costume party that we throw. And then after Halloween passes, we go into the beaning season where our crew will get together multiple times a week in various bars around the city. And we costume together. So we work on our bean suits with our hot glue guns. And, you know, that process for us goes from November until Lundi Gras Day, whenever that is, the Monday of Mondays. And then you have the Lanyap, which is Mardi Gras Day, which is also a wonderful day for many of our crew members. After that passes, we shake off the glitter and we do our charity event, Bean Madness, which is a spoof of the college basketball tournament. But we have a real, actual live tournament of 32 New Orleans chefs and restaurants that go head-to-head in a very elaborate and very silly tournament where there's, you know, 32 chefs. So we have 31 matches to get to eventually just one remaining champion who will win the Legume d'Or trophy.
The what?
The Legume d'Or.
Oh, the golden bean.
The golden bean. It's a very, very special trophy that will live in the kitchen for a year of the winner.
Who are the sort of restaurants and chefs who compete?
We have a full spectrum, everything from a very high-scale, fancy restaurant like Coquette to like very neighborhood spots, places like Joey K's, Jeffrey Hurd, Hurdette Kitchen are competing. But there's a full spectrum all over the city, really.
So now you have mobilized a force, your bean folk. They put in volunteer hours.
Yeah, we have all of our crew members help out because that's the only way to pull off a ridiculously elaborate charity event. You know, that's part of the capacity, I guess, of a growing crew, that we have the manpower and the woman power to get all this done.
Bravo. So what happens after you pick the golden bean? What happens to the crew of Red Bean then?
After that, after Bean Madness is over, my home turns back to normal. All the slow cookers go away. The bags of rice and beans go away. And then it's sort of like a hibernation planning period in the summertime, tweaking or changing various things that the crew will do the coming year, meeting with people, trying to figure out what is the way that our crew can be used for as a force of good in the city. And then before you know it, it's time to start all over again.
Devin, what great work. I'm so glad you're a New Orleanian.
Me too. I couldn't imagine living anywhere else.
Well, I always love having you on Louisiana Eat, so please come back and keep us filled in with the doings of the crew of Red Bean.
Will do, and see you out there on the streets and your beans. And thanks so much for having me.
That was Devin DeWolf, founder of the crew of Red Beans. Yes, my red beans is cooking, and I'm gonna give you some. Coming up next, we talk beans with a host of international food leaders at Slow Food Nations in Denver, Colorado. Louisiana Eats returns after the break.
People experience passion for all sorts of things, and this week we discover that in music. Music that speaks of a love of landscape, a love of homeland, and even of single malt whiskey. Travel with me beyond the notion of romantic love for a different kind of love song this week on The Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
Maysoon Zaid is a stand-up comic with cerebral palsy, and that's part of her shtick.
If if there was an oppression Olympics, I would win the gold medal. I'm Palestinian, Muslim, I'm female, I'm disabled, and I live in New Jersey.
Laughing through the pain, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
8 o'clock tonight on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from Ralph's on the Park, overlooking City Park's ancient oaks, serving locally sourced Gulf seafood, meats, and farm fresh produce, all presented with a global spin by Chef Chip Flanagan. Lunch, dinner, Saturday and Sunday brunch, and private parties at 900 City Park Avenue in Mid-City. Every year, Slow Food USA gathers together food leaders from across the globe for a three-day conference called Slow Food Nations. The event celebrates slow and sustainable food systems through summits, workshops, and street festivals. When Louisiana Eats attended back in July 2018, we spoke with local and international food leaders who offered their own unique insights into the power of the humble bean. One was farmer Evan Gregoire from Portland, Oregon. An avid seed collector, Evan created Portland Seed House in 2013, focusing on rare and unusual heirloom varieties. Evan is a faithful follower of the slow food philosophy, regularly attending conferences, including the biannual international slow food event in Italy, Terra Madre. When we spoke in Denver, I asked Greg to explain the connection he sees between beans and seeds.
Even when I was in Italy, when I traveled to Italy, I brought beans back with me. And, you know, basically you can declare food or you can declare seeds. And I declared them as food, but at the same time, I came back and I was not going to eat them. I was coming back to plant them, is because that's the thing. Beans are just very dried naturally, and so it's not a high heat process. And you can plant probably most of the beans that you get in the stores because they wouldn't be heated treated and they would just lose their nutritional values. So a lot of those beans, if they're not too old, will probably just go and germinate. And so that's life in the palm of your hand. And it's kind of a special, really interesting, super archetypical, you know, thing that's in everybody. It has that, you know, really that inner belief that you have those things that we have to grow these seeds in order to establish civilizations. And so it's something way deep inside you that I don't know where it comes from in me, maybe some ancestral, you know, back in Brussels in my hand, the sisterage, but I have no farmers in my background. It's not like I come from four lines of farmers, you know, in a generational pattern. So it's just something we have to explore and then really dig deeper on.
Is there a holy grail of seeds that you're searching for? Is there something unattainable? Or conversely, what was your most exciting find?
Well, in 2014, I went to Terra Madre. And Terra Madre is a wonderful slow food conference in Torino, Italy. And some of the things they have, Presidia items. And they have, Presidia items are basically products that have been established for many, many, even hundreds if not thousands of years. And so some of the beans, actually, I brought back from a Tuscan region called the Panzeride bean. And it's a 12 beans that grow in this Tuscan valley. And it's one of the village's beans. And it's the most spectacular. You can make jewelry out of it. I mean, it's that spectacular. It's mottled red, very crimson on one side, and then very white, shiny, glossy on the other. And so it has this dual tone pattern to it. But then it grows into these wonderful fresh-eating shelling beans, just like some of the wonderful Borlato types and things like that. But it's a very regional bean to a very exclusive family, as family's village region in Italy. So that's one of the things, is just finding those very unique things and those unique beans in Italy and in Terra Madre, and that's how slow food brought it all together for me, essentially.
How do you see your place in sort of saving the world? What is the thing that you do that gives the most back to you?
definitely seeing people tell me that they're rocking with a certain type of bean or a certain type of tomato that I sent to them in New Mexico or Florida or Maine or, you know, Sweden or anywhere, because it's the bigger picture. I mean, we're not, you know, you can't solve, you know, this problem in my lifetime, you know, in terms of, I feel like this is a lot larger problem that's going to be, you know, I'm so bad with cliches, but there is a cliche that goes like that. And it's just one of those things where you have to look beyond that. And so if we can all do our little drops in the buckets right now, in two generations, three generations, we'll be looking back at our generations going, you know, that's where they started seed saving. And that was the crux. And that was the pinnacle of, you know, the change. And even when we had a difficult time in the bureaucracy, you know, we still are, you know, huddling together. And there's so many wonderful cliches that you guys should throw out there about seeds, but it's you can't bury us, you know, you can't bury us because we're seeds. They didn't know we were seeds or whatever. There's that Mexican proverb. And so that's really what it is. I mean, it's life, and it's, when you touch it, it has an amazing energy and amazing, just it's that energy of life.
After talking with Evan, we had the opportunity to speak with Slow Food International's General Secretary, Paolo Di Croce. Paolo also believes that beans can change the world.
Definitely. We believe that we have, you know, that we organized Terra Madre, that maybe it's considered the biggest event, global event on small-scale farming, food quality, and there are many specific activities, especially on beans and on the different variety of beans, because there are 1,000 varieties everywhere in the world, and we have to promote diversity, and we have also to promote consumptions that are different from, you know, eating meat twice a day or doing the same thing that the majority of people are still doing. So I really think that you are doing something very, very important, not only for the future of the planet, but already for the present of the planet.
In addition to beans providing an alternative protein source and promoting diversity, they can also play an important role in the fight against food injustice. We spoke with academic and activist Raj Patel, who researches and advocates for sustainable models of agriculture. Raj explained to us how beans can help communities return to more natural systems.
One of the joys of agroecology is that it's the opposite of monoculture. And monoculture is where you grow one thing and you have to annihilate the rest of the field in order to be able to get your one thing. Beans are like the spine of agroecology. You can't have a rich and vibrant ecosystem without some way of getting nitrogen back in the soil. Beans are great for that. You can't really have a balanced diet without a rich source of protein. Beans are great at that. You can't really have a viable climate change, you know, robust agricultural system without a crop that can withstand extremes of heat and, you know, weird weather events. Some beans are fantastic at that. So I absolutely think that beans, they're not just good for your heart. The more you eat, the more you will save the planet. I think that that's true, but they have to be eaten in concert with a range of other things. There's no miracle cure. There's no, I mean, I imagine when we go out and have a look around the slow food market, there'll be people saying, if only everyone ate insects, everything would be fine. Or if we ate goji berries, or who knows what those things are. I mean, or whatever it is, quinoa, we will save the planet. And that's not true. There's no miracle thing that we eat that and only that and everything will be fine. What we need is diversity. And beans are a really important sort of anchor crop of a very rich and diverse ecosystem.
A real highlight of our 2018 trip to Denver was the opportunity to sit down with Chef Rick Bayless. Rick is a James Beard award-winning chef with several restaurants in Chicago. He also hosts his own public television series, Mexico, One Plate at a Time. During our conversation, Rick shared with me the connections he sees between our New Orleans red beans and rice tradition and his own experiences.
So that's very interesting that you talk about beans in New Orleans as being a Monday thing. When I was growing up, beans were also, I grew up in Oklahoma City, and beans were also a typical Monday thing. And I think it's from the same tradition, which is that used to be wash day. Mm-hmm. And so people would have a very simple meal on wash day because the women of the house, I mean, we're going back a really long time. Hopefully there's more gender equality now, but let's just go back and say the women of the household were spending their whole day doing all this wash, and it was not just throwing stuff in a washing machine. I mean, it was doing everything by hand. And so they would make really simple meals. That same meal is had in the Yucatan Peninsula. They do a black bean dinner, pot of black beans with some pork in it, and that's dinner on Mondays in the Yucatan Peninsula. Isn't it interesting how that in New Orleans, in the Yucatan, in Oklahoma City, that the tradition of having a bean meal on Mondays took deep root, and I guess it's just one of those things that kind of grew up through cultures.
What kind of beans were those that you were eating in Oklahoma City?
Okay, so we would cook pinto beans with ham hock, okay, and then we would serve it always with what my grandmother called chow chow, and chow chow in our way of thinking of it was pickled jalapenos, that was the base of it, raw carrots, you put all this through a meat grinder, so pickled jalapenos, raw carrots, and a small amount of cabbage, and then that would sort of pickle along with everything else. Some people put onion in it, some people didn't, but my grandmother used to make that and then can it. And then we would have that always on that Monday bean dinner with cornbread. We didn't have it with rice. You guys have, your starch was rice. Ours was cornbread. And honest to God, that was my favorite meal of the week. The pintos cooked with ham hock, the chow chow, and the cornbread.
Well, it sounds to me like in your life you have been on a very long journey with beans, Rick.
Yeah.
Take us from the pintos in Oklahoma to what you do today. And I'd like to know from you the importance to you of beans in the world today.
So when I went to Mexico for the first time, I went to Mexico City. Mexico is divided into two sections bean-wise, okay? There's the part that's north of Mexico City, and that is the light-colored beans. You could think about pintos, but there's one that's called bayo that's kind of a pinkish color, flor de mayo, which is a tanner color. But those are the northern beans. And then just north of Mexico City, it switches, and everybody goes into black beans. And all the rest of Mexico is all about black beans. And when I had the opportunity to live in Mexico for a long time, one of the places I lived was in Oaxaca, and I fell in love with this one small black bean that's their heirloom bean. It comes from a small town in the South Valley called San Antonio. And it makes the absolute blackest bean broth you could ever imagine. And so they cook that up, and you can make it into soup if you want to. But in Oaxaca, they like to puree the beans completely and then do a frying in the pan. I know that everybody in the United States calls these beans refritos or frijoles refritos. And they say and then we translate it as refried beans. That refritos in Spanish means really well fried beans, not fried again, but well fried beans. So frijoles refritos are these ones where you make this black bean puree and it's jet black, and then you put some fresh rendered pork lard into a skillet, and then you add the bean puree and you just cook it, and it almost becomes like this bean paste. And in fact, they often, especially in the state of Veracruz, they'll roll it out like it was a French rolled omelet. And they'll roll it out onto a plate and sprinkle it with fresh cheese over the top of it. It's absolutely spectacular. And that stuff has so many uses. I mean, you can spread it on a bread and then put a little cheese over the top of it and make what's called a mollete. You can serve it alongside things. You can serve it at room temperature. It's really delicious spread on a tostada and then topped with a little pickled pig's feet if you're inclined to that direction. But there's so many different things that you could do with it. We mentioned earlier about the Yucatan Peninsula and the black bean dinner that they do there typically on the Mondays. And that one is flavored with pork, but then it has this this sauce on the side that is tomato with habanero chili. It's a cook sauce, actually, that you kind of add to it, and then oftentimes they'll do an habanero chili relish to go with it. So really making it a lot spicier.
Oh, you're making me so hungry for beans.
You can tell I love beans. I grew up in beans. And the one thing I didn't say is that I've eaten beans since I was a little kid, not just that pinto bean dinner. But remember, I grew up in a barbecue restaurant, and one thing that you always find in a barbecue restaurant is barbecue beans or baked beans. And so I grew up on that, and I still love them to no end.
Is there a favorite bean dish in your restaurants that people really come to you for?
Well, we change our menus all the time, so those poor guests, they can't just always assume that we're going to have everything that we have had in the past. So if you fall in love with a dish, you might need to call ahead and see if it's on the menu. But I will say we do a sort of elegant version of that black bean dinner, that Yucatan black bean dinner, with a roasted suckling pig on it that, to me, is just one of the best dishes you'll ever eat. And we also always, we make that the Oaxaca style bean puree cooked down with the fresh rendered pork fat, and we serve that alongside Oaxacan black mole, which is the one dish that's always on the menu in our fine dining place Topolobampo, and we serve that with Wagyu beef and black mole, that little bit of beans, and then there's changing things, other things go on that plate. But I will say that flavor of beans, black beans, and mole, that you can't beat that. That's just a match made in heaven.
After talking beans with so many global leaders at Slow Food Nations, I knew I couldn't leave without sitting down with New Orleans native son, Richard McCarthy. Richard is the founder of the Crescent City Farmers Market and, when we spoke with him in 2018, the executive director of Slow Food USA. Richard and I tucked into a cozy spot downtown where almost 100 food producers and organizations from all over the world set up in an open-air market. Richard was excited that one of his hometown favorites, Camellia Brand, was a festival sponsor. Camellia is also a sponsor of Louisiana Eats. He explained how beans are a vital part of Slow Food's mission to provide good, clean, and fair food for all.
Our theme this year is Food for Change, recognizing that indeed food is a cause of climate change. One-fifth of carbon emissions are due to food. Food is also a victim of climate change. The loss of biodiversity is tragic. And, you know, when I think about that, I get really depressed. I want to curl up in a fetal position. Except that when I think about food, more importantly, it is a solution for climate change. And it's one that we can taste and touch every single day. And what we need to begin to change the narrative of these sort of old-fashioned businesses like Camellia Beans is that they're in carbon farming. They support the farmers who are putting carbon back into the soil. There is nothing more important than more grain and legume and bean production. And they do that not in some little boutique corner of the world. They do it in mainstream supermarkets, impacting everyday people with everyday cooking. And then add on top of that, their business is dried beans. And I'm sure, Poppy, you've experienced this. Young people have no idea how easy it is to prepare a meal with dried beans. They're opening up cans, they're opening up their freezer. Dried beans are like, I think, almost the answer to the very question about, is the food movement, is slow food elitist? I can't think of anything more slow food than eating a meal prepared from dried beans. And that is the food of peasants. That is the food of ancient food of communities who farm and live and eat and believe in a place. And so for Camellia, this extraordinary family enterprise, to be here, to be part of this in the middle of the country, new terrain, where we celebrate the importance of beans as the basis of every cultural food, is exciting. Because we know that red beans and rice, and in particular Camellia's red beans and rice, are like what defines who we are. But when I think of chickpeas and the role of hummus in every Middle Eastern culture, and the fact that that is such an important product that Camellia produces.
And pintos.
And pinto beans, when, and especially being here in Denver, with an extraordinarily vibrant and large Mexican population, pinto beans are identifiable as to who we are. And this is the exciting thing about food. Food is and should always be so much more than just fuel. Food, and we should defend this heroically, that food provides us with a profound sense of joy and pleasure, first of all. And this is our mirepoix of the food movement. First of all, profound pleasure. Secondly, an important sense of identity. And I think of the red bean. It says we are Creoles in New Orleans. The pinto bean, we are Mexicans, or we are First Nations in the Southwest. An important sense of identity, and we must defend our identities in a time of horrific global homogenization. But beyond that, the most important element is the third, which is that food is a bridge between people. And we have got to build more bridges and fewer walls. And food is the means to do that.
When I saw that the theme was food for change, I began to think, to me, beans are the rock star of food for change.
They are.
First of all, the seasonality. Doesn't matter what season you're in, there's a bean that'll go beautifully along with what's seasonal. Eat less meat. Well, beans are that meat substitute. They simply are the food for change. But there's another idea I wanted to plant in you. I spoke with a member of your delegation today who is a seed farmer. And he told me beans are life. And that's because beans really are seeds. So Richard, when we eat beans, I think we're planting seeds within ourselves.
I love that, because we are the change.
We are the change. We are the change.
It's plant the change, see. Eat the change.
Be the change.
Be the change. Or bean the change.
Bean the change. Bean the change you want to see in the world.
Well, I'm going out to Denver. See if I can't find.
That was Richard McCarthy and a host of international food leaders speaking to us in 2018 at Slow Food Nations in Denver.
That loving Colorado girl of mine.
Who is the most famous American celebrity whose name has always been associated with red beans and rice? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Be there tomorrow. Now, Mama, don't you cry.
KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Get yourself a Tita's de Cafe and drop a quarter into La Lu Jukebox with me, your host, Blake Miller. This jukebox plays all the good stuff. Cajun, country, small pop, Cajun music that sounds like small pop that sounds like country, country that sounds like Cajun, Cajun that sounds like...
That's La Lu Jukebox with Blake Miller, Saturday night at 6 and Sunday morning at 7, right here on KRVS.
It's old, oh yeah.
but it's still relevant. Things change, but not our love of gold. Music gold, for sure. And the vault is full on the Old Gold Show. Classic and time-tested hits. Take that nostalgic trip with us on Thursdays at noon on 88.7 KRVS. I'm Lee Kleinpeter. And I
thank you. Later today on This American Life. Each year the U.S. gives out some green cards in a lottery. A Somali refugee wins one. Then he faces the Kenyan police, a lynch mob, and one seemingly impossible task after another.
Did you expect to die?
I did.
Later today, we return to the story that we first aired years ago with an update about what has happened to him this year here in America.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Louisiana Fish Fry. Breadings, boils, new air fry mixes, and more classic Louisiana dishes available everywhere. Let's all Louisiana. And from the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission, located 40 minutes from New Orleans French Quarter, the North Shore's Tammany Taste features the chefs and farmers, brewers and bakers of St. Tammany Parish's culinary scene. Visit LouisianaNorthShore.com to discover more. Louisiana's North Shore, where New Orleans has come to play and get away for more than a century. This week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Who is the most famous American celebrity whose name has always been associated with red beans and rice? That's New Orleans' own Louis Armstrong, who famously closed his correspondence with the valediction, "Red beans and ricely yours." Louis's favorite red beans and rice included three kinds of pork, tomato sauce, bell pepper, and dried hot peppers, along with the more ordinary seasonings of garlic and onion. Louis was so serious about his red beans and rice that while courting his northern-born fourth wife, Lucille Wilson, he asked her to cook up a batch. Lucille was so successful that not only did he marry her, a marriage that endured for almost three decades until his death in 1971, but he also proudly accompanied her on Merv Griffin's popular daytime talk show, where she cooked the beans for a studio audience. You'll find Louis and Lucille's recipe on our website at poppytooker.com. You can learn more about Louis and his relationship with red beans by visiting Camellia Brand's Red Bean Hall of Fame at our home away from home, the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. There, you can also try on handmade costumes beaned by the crew of Red Beans. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Louis Armstrong's red beans and rice make for some real Louisiana eats.
My name is Judy Burks, and I've been cooking red beans at the Jazz Festival since 1974.
And I'm Morris Douglas, and I've been with Judy since probably 1979.
For those who come to Jazz Fest year after year, there's several mainstays they expect to find when they arrive at the fairgrounds. For some, it's the gospel tent. For others, it's the contemporary crafts area. And for many more, it's their favorite Jazz Fest eats. Judy Burke's Red Beans booth has been woven into the very fabric of Jazz Fest. She's been stirring her pot at the festival for over 40 years. We were honored to be invited to Judy's house to talk with Judy and her red bean partner, Morris Douglas.
I fell in love with the Jazz Fest in 1973. It was my first Jazz Fest, although it wasn't the first Jazz Fest. It was the first one at the fairgrounds. And so I proposed that my boyfriend at the time and I had a great black beans recipe, and we would try our black beans. There were not a lot of people who were kind of wanting to do that. Nobody was sure whether it was going to be profitable. And in fact, in my first year, we broke even after a whole lot of work. And we had to invest in some pots, and we had to learn how to cook in quantity. Got a lot of advice. I remember the first time we tried to make rice in a huge quantity. It was a total flop. And these two nice old ladies from Reserve who were making rice in the fairgrounds kitchen came over and said, "Honey, this is not how you do it. Let me show you." And they actually, you know, gave us a little tutorial about how to make rice and not have it turn into mush. So we were just picking up things as we went. We didn't really know how much we didn't know, but we certainly found out.
So you started off with the black beans.
Right.
Because there already were red beans at the festival.
Right, and Buster Holmes was the red beans guy.
The famous Buster Holmes.
The famous Buster Holmes. So after year one of the break even with the black beans thing, I got a phone call from the Jazz Fest, and they said, "Buster Holmes doesn't want to do anything but 100 pounds of beans, and he has a restaurant to run, and he wants to fix that and get out. And there are lines of people wanting red beans. And we know that you all know how to cook black beans, so do you think you could start doing red beans instead?" And it was really no contest, because it was clear that you could make money selling red beans and that maybe you couldn't selling black beans.
Morris, what are your earliest memories? So you're in high school when you start out there.
Well, what happened is Judy started doing it, and I says, "I want to help. I want to come."
Morris started high school at Rob Wynn, and I started teaching at Rob Wynn, teaching art.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was one of my students. Right. So I was looking for up-and-coming, sort of energetic youngsters to have come out and work in the booth. And he, of course, was the number one choice. And if anybody from Rob Wynn is listening,
you missed your big opportunity.
I mean it.
So I started working with Judy, and I was a booth person in the front, you know. "Come on over. Come on. Come on."
And he never wanted to work in the kitchen because he's a people person. He wanted to be out there, you know, introducing himself and talking to people. But eventually I talked him into coming into the kitchen and working.
And it was fun. I just, I told her, "I will work as much as I can, Judy." And she said, "Okay." And I worked the whole fest. Then several years passed, and, you know, I got older, and I said, "You know, I want to be your partner. I want to be your partner." Just saying it, you know, just saying it. And finally that happened. We became partners, me, Judy, and my sister, Pam.
Now, you all cook in 75-pound batches.
Yes.
If you had to guess, how many pounds every year on average do you think you use?
Probably 1,500 pounds during the festival, or maybe, you know, give or take. The recipe involves a lot of, I can't tell you.
You're not going to tell y'all a secret.
No, you don't have to.
But we use good sausage and lots of ham and lots of white pepper, black pepper, red pepper. But I would say for the last maybe 20 years, we've stuck with our proven formula for making these beans.
Yeah, we haven't changed. We haven't changed.
I think there's a lot of people who have this mistaken idea that being a Jazz Fest vendor is like getting Willy Wonka's golden ticket. You know, it's like, oh my goodness.
One of the things about being out there is you really are taking your chance. It's weather-based kind of event. And sometimes you do well, and sometimes you just have to accept what happened.
And last year it rained twice. One day was almost all, you know, we was washed out for with that Sunday, first Sunday. And then they have weeks, years where you don't have any rain. You have 7 great days, you know.
Having just done the taxes, I can tell you it's not a gold mine. It's a nice gig, and it's fun to do.
Before we start, you know, we anticipate and we get ready. And I says, you know, I'm excited about working, doing Jazz Fest because I get to be with you for 2 weeks, a whole 2 weeks, you know. And she chuckles, and she knows what I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that's another thing about working at the festival that we both enjoy, is we get together with the same people that we've known for all these years, and we know them for that brief period of time, the 2 weeks that we work together, and it's as if we've never been apart. I mean, we pick up where we left off. We help each other. We see their kids grow up and work in the booth, who started off being this tall, are now adults, you know.
What is your favorite moment every year at the fest?
I remember going out when the festival had those old-fashioned tents that were more like circus tents that were spread around in the center of the field, and they wouldn't mow the clover. They would just install the tents. And you'd walk out there early in the morning, and there would be dew everywhere. And one of my favorite times was when somebody was doing a sound check, and in the midst of the clover and the old tents, they played Aaron Neville singing Amazing Grace. It was really a wonderful moment. And that kind of thing, you know, where you grab a few special minutes for yourself and something happens like that. Early on, too, when we were small and didn't have a lot of responsibilities and weren't as old and as tired as we are now, at the end of the day, we would run down to hear the final set, you know, and it might be Professor Longhair closing out the show.
I want to tell you my favorite, move-in day. And you move in, and then you get to see everybody you haven't seen for the last year. All of the other vendors, and I like that. You know, you get that little feeling that we got this 2 weeks together, you know. And then the next favorite moment is opening day. You said it. You're in there before everybody, and you know you're anticipating, and it's a special feeling. It really is.
That was Judy Burks and Morris Douglas, making the Red Beans magic happen annually at New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival.
You thought it was, but I was with love. Oh, but now I believe that I'm fine, still but blind.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions and hear all about upcoming special events by visiting poppytooker.com. Don't miss our latest Tammany Taste Quick Bites podcast, featuring King Cake Royalty, the Randazzo family of Randazzo's Camellia City Bakery. You'll also find videos, recipes, and can even order personalized cookbooks there. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Camellia Brand Beans, and the St. Tammany Tourist Commission. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Bourbon House, from oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood and American whiskey on Bourbon Street. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and special projects manager Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
We're on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.